From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And in a few minutes, because of a glut of oil, the number of rigs operating in the U.S. has fallen, which means oil workers are fighting to keep their once plentiful jobs. We'll hear from one.
But first, the new CEO of McDonald's announced a plan today to overhaul the company, which has been struggling to keep up with the competition. The plan is being billed as a modernization of McDonald's, which saw profits fall 15% last year. Here's CEO Steve Easterbrook.
The numbers don't lie, which is why, as we celebrate 60 years of McDonald's, I will not shy away from the urgent need to reset this business. How we think, how we take decisions, how we organize, how we respond to customers and their changing needs, and how we galvanize against competitive threats.
Alicia Kelso is a contributing editor at QSR Web. That's a publication that covers the fast food industry. She's with us from Louisville, Kentucky. Alicia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about what Mr. Easterbrook said today. What kind of changes are coming to McDonald's?
Essentially, his presentation focused on two big items. One was refranchising a significant amount of the system. I think he said 3,500 restaurants to be exact. And then the second one was sort of a realignment of some of his systems, so breaking it down, you know, the U.S.-based stores, and then Australia, Canada, France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, and then his high-growth markets, which are China, Italy, Poland, and Russia.
Well, take us through those two things, and let's start with splitting the company up in a way into those three categories. Why does that help McDonald's to have one focused on the U.S., one focused on developed markets, one focused on developing markets?
I think that's just a matter of efficiency. You know, for a long time now, McDonald's has, especially internationally, grown really fast in some markets, and other markets has sort of been hemorrhaging sales. And it's hard to take a streamlined approach or to be very efficient when you have markets all over the world doing all sorts of different things. So honestly, I think this is, you know, McDonald's may have been taking a page from its competitor Yum Brands.
Which owns KFC, Pizza Hut, Burger King.
And Taco Bell, yes. And Yum Brands, I think a year or two ago, did something similar by restructuring its different markets. And I think it's just a way to put a point person in charge of each of these markets and do what they need to do to focus on those markets specifically, because they do behave so differently.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that have to do more with the customers that are being proposed here, including a simplification of restaurant operations. What does that mean, and what are we likely to see at McDonald's as a result?
You know, they're going to reduce a significant amount of menu items, which, you know, that's been a big suggestion for a long time, as McDonald's menu just got so out of control. I think they added like 40 new items since 2007. When you promote yourself as a fast food restaurant, that's based mostly on convenience, and your speed of service is slow and almost as slow as a fast casual with perceived higher quality food, that's going to cause you to fumble a lot, and it's going to cause you to lose a lot of consumers who just get frustrated and they go elsewhere. They also just announced that they're going to take antibiotics out of their chicken supply, and you know, those are big, meaningful changes, but it seems like they should be promoting that a little bit more than, you know, perhaps the big financial announcements that they made. I just think that, you know, customers will care more about that.
Well, big picture, do you see McDonald's becoming more like a Chipotle, let's say, something where you can see the food, you can choose what you want in it, and you've got what are at least perceived as fresher ingredients?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, and I wish I had an answer for that. But, you know, in covering this industry, I have gotten a lot of different messages in a very little amount of time. And I know that part of that's because they have a transitioned into a new leadership. But it seems like this company, for a long time, since Jim Skinner retired, has been throwing darts at the wall to see what's going to stick. And, you know, we do see them testing a create your own burger line, in Southern California. Well, initially when that test came out, it was in-store only, but now they're going to try and test a drive-through. And, you know, are they testing breakfast all day? They are in some markets. So there's just been a lot of different messages coming out. You know, they're focusing more on regional burgers. I know here in Louisville, we have, a burger that's come out with a bourbon-based sauce. Hmm. So that is kind of a nod to fast casual. But if you look at some of the, what the consumers are saying, a lot of them are just begging them to get back to their basics. It's not a fast casual brand. It was never meant to be. I don't know if it can compete with the Five Guys and the Smash Burgers and the Chipotles. I think that's a big hill to climb for a company that's been around as long as McDonald's.
That's Alicia Kelso, a contributing editor at QSR Web, talking with us about McDonald's. The new CEO, Steve Easterbrook, making a big announcement today about a new change in strategy for McDonald's. Alicia, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, oil prices reached 5-month highs today. There's been a glut of oil worldwide, but thanks in part to better than expected economic growth in Europe, there's more demand and therefore producers are charging more. But when oil prices fall, as they've done over the last 6 months because of that glut, one of the first things companies do is cut back on workers and on the number of drilling rigs. On Friday, the firm Baker Hughes said the number of rigs operating in the U.S. has fallen to the lowest level since September 2010. Fewer rigs means more competition for jobs. For Inside Energy, Neil LaRubio tells us what it's like to be one of those oil workers fighting to keep his place. And a warning, we thought some of the language used to express that may be a little too colorful for some listeners.
I've spent 2 years living on an oil well pad. Our single wide trailer is cramped like an airplane fuselage. A constant drone of diesel engines seems to cordon us off from the outside world. I survey oil wells, which means I operate a kind of compass that directs the drill bit and maps the rock layers. After setting the compass in the hole, I stare at a computer for hours as the drill digs its way down. Workers on the well pad call people in my position the movie-watching dude.
Please say morale, he was kept, but he won't talk unless they pay him.
I share the trailer with another surveyor and two drillers. We can be on the same well pad in the same fuselage for a long time.
Can you guys say exactly what you just said?
I set you up. I teed it up. I set you up.
We peck at each other out of insecurity or out of boredom or just for sport.
Neil, tell me the truth. What did you think about my orange underwear?
I thought I have some just like those.
The oil field was a reasonably comfortable place to work. The guys on my team are all earning somewhere between $400 and $800 a day until the end of last year.
Oil prices slumped to a 5-year low today, with U.S. crude briefly breaching the symbolic $50 threshold. Let's go live.
We talked about it constantly.
Do you think we're all out of jobs for the rest of the year then? Is that what you're saying?
Hey, it could be down to $15, $20.
I think if it gets up into the 60s, work will pick back up.
Maybe. Our service company was trying to hold on to as much work as possible. We heard rumors that the oil company that hired our services wanted to replace us with a cheaper company. And one day recently, while drilling a well just outside of Denver, it all came true. Some company from Louisiana outbid us. My coworker, Dale Thompson, was not happy.
Yes, it was. My are coming out here to do our jobs, yeah. And they can't do it because we're better. Because we're from Texas.
And he's probably right. We cut 9 days off last year's drill time. We just drilled a 5-day well.
The experience won't matter. It's going to be about money. How much money can you put into my pocket?
So now, none of us know when we're going to get work next. And when we do, it probably won't be anywhere near here. While we did end-of-job chores, we stewed on what was happening.
And this might be goodbye to the oil field. I was never cut off for this anyways.
What are you going to do when you go home? Are you going to be depressed and drink?
A depression hole. So we started packing up. Bedding, clothes, protein powders, dumbbells, and whatever else we had accumulated. And then we took off.
I'm not getting goodbyes.
Not either. I was just saying, see you later.
See you later.
Later, guys. Don't drive safe.
All right, you too.
Leaving the well pad, I feel like a red-eyed gambler walking away from the casino. I'm exhausted from 35 straight days of work, from sleeping during the day rather than night, from adrenaline spikes when the pressure is high, and now there is no work in sight. The money illusions have dissipated. I'm trying to ignore that lost feeling. It's time to reacclimate to society and home life again. I find my son, Nico, nursing a cold in bed.
Are you going to work today?
No, I just got back from work. I'm going to stay home for a long time this time.
For Here and Now, I'm Neil Rubio in Colorado.
This week's photo on the cover of Time magazine tells one of the narratives of the unrest last week in Baltimore. A single black man is running down the street away from an approaching phalanx of police officers in riot gear, charging after him, clubs raised. That's the narrative from Ferguson to the recent Justice Department report that found unarmed black men were being singled out by heavily armed local police forces. But there's another story behind the picture. It's the story of the photographer, 26-year-old self-taught Baltimore native Devin Allen. His pictures from last week went not only to the cover of Time, but they went viral. Rihanna retweeted them. And it seemed to us that maybe his story is also in some ways the story of Baltimore. And Devin joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we're going to have your pictures at hereandnow.org, but start with the one on the cover. What was happening when you took that picture of the man running?
Well, that picture was captured on Saturday, the 25th, and basically it was a peaceful day. It was a peaceful rally, but it got a little out of hand, and the cause of that were the police putting on their riot gear, and I'm slowly approaching because of the other rioters that was basically defacing and destroying the police cause. So what the police started to approach, and the guys, he took off running right past me, you know, and as I looked up, the police was like right in my face at that point. They came faster than I thought they was going to come. And the police, they could have ran me over, you know, broke my equipment, but they didn't. They actually helped me get over the railing, you know, so.
So we have a lot of questions for you, but one's just kind of technical. Why black and white? It's printed in black and white.
The main reason is because, you know, black and white is pretty much straightforward, you know. If I see a lot of color, it makes me pay attention to so much in the picture because the colors are popping, there's color all over the place. So I was like, I think if I gave them that old feel, that black and white, they'll feel more emotion. And then with one of my favorite photographers, Gordon Parks, you know, I just feel as though black and white hits harder.
Of course, Gordon Parks, the iconic African-American photographer,
yes.
Who shot often in black and white. Well, you said early on you were determined to show the good, the bad, and the ugly of what was happening in your beloved city, and you've got pictures of young men jumping on police cars, smashing windows as the violence started after Freddie Gray's funeral. We've now moved to Monday. Pictures of it looks like a black person pouring water on a white protester's face to lessen the sting of pepper spray, a young boy standing his back to the camera in front of two police officers in riot gear, again in Baltimore. But just to this point that you said you were determined to show everything about your city, it's one thing to be a photographer. Now you're being a journalist during this event. Because you love the city so much and grew up, you know, just around the corner from where Freddie Gray was picked up, do you think you were capable of showing things that maybe might not put the protesters in a sympathetic light or might put the police, who, for instance, helped you over the fence, in a sympathetic light?
Kind of, sort of. I did my best. You know, I'm not no journalist or anything, and I'm getting a lot of heat from real photographers and journalists saying that I'm doing a terrible job, but I'm a guy with two cameras, and basically, I went to every single rally, every single protest. Even when it wasn't a protest, I still was outside. You know, I try to capture every angle and not to be biased, you know, because I have met some pretty cool police officers, you know, and I have met some protesters, people that rioted, you know. Everybody is real emotional, and I try to tell everyone's story in every image.
Well, first of all, Devin, we haven't heard this. Which professional photographers are saying you're doing a terrible job? Because you're obviously, you know, the people at Time don't think so.
I know. You know, I have caught a lot of heat on Instagram and on Twitter, and I even had, you know, animosity from photographers here. It kind of hurts a little bit because that's what I aspire to be, a photographer.
Well, let's talk about what some of that, maybe it's professional jealousy, might be. I mean, you are, as we said, self-taught. And do I understand that you only picked up a camera in 2013, around the same time you lost your job?
Yes. I started 2012, but I didn't even have a camera. I just used my friend's little Coolpix like type camera to take pictures and put on T-shirts. So I actually purchased my first camera December of 2012. You know, I didn't start taking pictures till 2013, and I did teach myself. I watched a couple YouTube tutorials here and there, and I learned most of everything I know through trial and error.
Well, and just to underscore, you loved it, but also it became something to do after, was it Transamerica that moved out of Baltimore to another state and you had worked at that insurance company?
Yes, I worked at Transamerica for 3 years as a workflow coordinator. And yes, they up and moved our job to Texas, and we didn't know anything about it. They just called us into a corner and was like, hey, we're moving your job to Texas. And
yeah. What are you doing now for work?
I work with people with autism and intellectual disabilities.
Do I understand you do that overnight?
Yes, 12 a.m. to 8 a.m., Monday through Friday.
And then go take your pictures?
Yes.
Okay, that's, when do you sleep?
Lately, I really haven't really slept. Like, I take cat naps, you know, I really don't have time to sleep. And then a lot of people in my city are looking, you know, they call my phone. They want to know where the rally's at. They want to know where to be, you know.
Well, you have become something of not just a coordinator, but a voice online. It's not just your pictures that are going out, but you send tweets, too. Things like when the riots started to happen, you tweeted out, please don't lose focus. Times will get hard, but don't forget the goal. We want justice, not riots. Friends and family of Freddie Gray have been peaceful since day one. I saw it with my own eyes, heard it with my own ears. Respect, don't tarnish that. You've become a voice.
Yeah. It's still unreal to me, you know, because this is like my city. Like, people don't even, like, I have a nickname here. People don't even call me, like, Devin Allen. Most people know me by, like, my childhood nickname, you know, so it's like,
which is
weird.
Which is what?
Everyone knows me in Baltimore as Moody. You know, a lot of my friends know me as that.
Well, now you're being tweeted out by Rihanna.
Yeah, Rihanna, Beyonce, they're posting it, and it's just unreal.
Well, how do you think your personal story reflects Baltimore's story? You know, you had Transamerica, you had a business pull out, and you lost your job. One of the biggest problems in Baltimore is unemployment for the inner city. And yet, look what's happened to you. There, you know, a positive light has shone on you, and who knows what's going to happen with your photography. What are you saying? Maybe some good for the city can come out of what's happened?
Yes, I think I shed a lot of light on the city, and good in the bad way, because I didn't want people to just say, oh, he just... Nah, she's not showing everything. Like, I show protesters and riders, you know, fighting, you know, or people being negative. I depicted that, you know, and with Baltimore, you know, I love the city with all my heart. So I just think people connected to Baltimore in a way that they couldn't connect with it through, like, media and in the news. You know, I had people taking my pictures. Like, a guy took one of my pictures and made a poster saying keep the peace all the way in New Orleans, you know, and a lot of people are saying, like, why haven't you put your name on your pictures? I didn't put my name on these pictures because I wanted them to go viral. I wanted everybody to post them. I wanted people to see.
This has been extraordinary. Your pictures have been viewed by millions, but you don't get paid for that.
No.
And by the way, we assume you were paid for the cover of Time.
Yes.
but still, that doesn't support a career.
It's because it's not about the money. That's why I keep stressing to people, because money comes and goes. I'm just blessed that I made history. You know, that's the biggest achievement for me and my family, that I left a mark. You know, I was shooting models and shooting parties, and I can book shoots and get paid, but I canceled all that, you know, like, because at the end of the day, I can't be selfish with a God-given talent. The universe blessed me with this talent, and all this pain is around me. I had to use it for good. And if I did it for money, it would be tarnished. You know, I did this from the heart.
Yeah. You obviously are in support of the protesters, at least in their goal of justice for Freddie Gray. You've made that very clear in some of your tweets. What would you say to the young men and women in Baltimore who were the ones who went to the malls and who you're talking to in the tweets and saying, you know, please keep your focus on the goal, especially when it comes to your story? What would you say to them?
People got to just remember, these are kids. These kids are emotional. You know, I call us the forgotten ones, because people forgot about Baltimore. You know, even the mayor here forgot about us. You know, this city has been bad. We've been in pain. So people need to understand, like, that pain that those kids released on that Monday, that's bent up pain from their parents, from the struggle. And people need, I want people to understand that. People are not trying to understand. They're just pointing the finger. And for those kids, they stood up for what they believed and they did what they did because that's what they wanted to do. I really can't comment on it, you know. I didn't want my city to burn, you know. I didn't want to see it like that, you know. But they if it wasn't for them, we would never have all this media coverage. I don't think those guys would have been charged as fast if Monday would have never happened. Mm. I want people to understand that. If that would have never happened, we wouldn't have been to this point, you know.
Yeah. Well, Devin Allen, we also know part of your story is that you dropped out of community college, but I'm guessing that, you know, you don't need college right now. You have your skill.
Oh, no, I'm probably going to go back to school.
You are?
My thing was I didn't used to believe in myself until, like, really now. Like, I knew I was okay. You know, it's a lot of amazing photographers out here. I follow a lot of amazing ones, you know. And I'm like, I'm all right. You know, I'm from Baltimore. You know, I travel to New York a lot just to get my name out there even more. You know, and it's like, after this situation, I want to take this further. You know, I want to go do movies and do film. So I'm thinking about going to film school, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, this situation really inspired me and inspired a lot of people here. A lot of people here have faith now. The photographers and the artists here are inspired now. So it's a lot of great things I just feel is coming, not just for me, but for my city in general.
We wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
That's Devin Allen, Baltimore native. His photographs from the streets of his hometown last week have gone viral. One's on the cover of Time magazine. You can see them at hereandnow.org. Devin, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the most unpopular companies in America today reported that its earnings rose 10% in the first quarter of this year, beating expectations. I'm talking about Comcast here, which also added hundreds of thousands of high-speed internet customers. But the picture is far from perfect for the country's largest cable provider. Comcast recently abandoned that $45 billion deal to buy Time Warner Cable amid increasing scrutiny from regulators and new rules from the FCC on net neutrality. Joining us now is Jill Schlesinger of CBS News. Jill, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
And what is behind today's report? Why are they doing so well, despite the fact that a lot of customers don't love them?
We hate them, but we're stuck with them. That's really the message here. And this is really about growth of that high-speed internet business, as you said. You know, look, it's unbelievable to think about this, but total revenue for this company just in the quarter, almost $18 billion. That's just insanity, right? Now, if you take sales out that were attributed to the Super Bowl or in 2014 Sochi Olympics, because both of those were on NBC and Comcast owns them, revenue actually increased by a very healthy amount, 7.2% during the period. That's what investors were very focused on.
And are the people who are helping Comcast get that revenue going in there for cable or internet or both?
Well, it's really about the internet. In fact, the company actually lost 8,000 video subscribers for the quarter, and there were more than 400,000 high-speed internet customers added. Now, I think this is kind of interesting because it really does underscore one of the reasons that the Department of Justice and the FCC were going to block the Comcast merger with Time Warner Cable, because they said, look, this combined entity would have controlled 57% of the broadband market. Now, that could make it pretty easy to raise prices or limit access to content, maybe even alter how we use the internet. And because the high-speed internet connections are so important for everyday lives these days, we're not going back to dial-up.
And by the way, when I said one of the most unpopular companies in America, where there's a consumer satisfaction survey, it came out, Comcast came in second to last. The only company that beat it was Time Warner Cable. So
yes, it was a combination of the most hated companies. I mean, it's totally unbelievable. And it is true. One note, though, I actually went to college and shared a house with the CEO of Time Warner Cable. Hmm. I should only point out a hat tip to my mother who said, you should have fallen in love with him. Because well, he was about to get $80 million.
Would have said, I'll meet you for dinner at some point between 12 and 4. So, Jill, I want to ask you about one other thing while we're talking cable TV. Big fight over the weekend, of course. The big boxing match between Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao delayed 45 minutes after distributors faced a lot of high demand, but a lot of people watched it for free on these apps, the Meerkat, Periscope. What's the lesson from this fight for cable TV?
Well, I think these problems were pretty much widespread. All the providers, Time Warner Cable, Optimum, DirecTV, Charter, Comcast, so everyone had the same issue. And it's just one event, so I'm not sure that we're going to see the same trend that we saw from the music industry. But I think this kind of reminds me of a restaurant that says, your food's taking a long time at Mother's Day brunch because it's crowded. Don't they plan for big crowds at these companies? Anyway,
yeah,
I think we'll wait till the next big event to see whether we get a little more pickup here and better service,
well,
of
and
course.
The price of that pay-per-view, a lot of people on those Comcast bills won't even notice it because they're already paying so much as it is. Jill Schlesinger of CBS News, thank you so much.
Take care.
Are you having a bad day? I assure you, it wasn't as bad as Charles Epting Van Sant's was on July 1st, 1916, when he became the victim of the first fatal shark attack in non-tropical waters in the U.S. It was on a beach in New Jersey in front of his family. It was awful. Then there was August 26, 1346, the day the blind king of Bohemia asked his men to tie their horses together and follow him into battle. They did, and all were slain. Now, those were very, very, very bad days. But just regular bad days? Well, that would include yesterday, May 3rd in 2003, the old man of the mountain, the granite cliffs in New Hampshire that looked like, well, an old man. Well, he fell off, an iconic landmark, just gone. That was a bad day in New Hampshire. Michael Farquhar has compiled a year's worth of bad days in a new book called, appropriately enough, Bad Days in History, a gleefully grim chronicle of misfortune, mayhem, and misery for every day of the year. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. Michael, welcome.
Robin, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit more. People in New England are familiar with this, but the old man of the mountain meant so much to people in New Hampshire. If you look at your New Hampshire state quarter, he's there. That's his image. And he'd also been immortalized in other ways?
Daniel Webster once said of the old man, "Men hang out their signs indicative of their respective trades. Shoemakers hang out a gigantic shoe, jewelers a monster watch, and a dentist hangs out a gold tooth. But in the mountains of New Hampshire, God Almighty has hung out a sign to show that there he makes men."
Yeah, and you actually quote a local who, with that in mind, also quotes God upon the old man's falling.
A representative of the Park Service, Mike Pelcher, said, "We always thought it was the hand of God holding him up, and he let go."
Yeah. And so you write about days like that where nobody dies, but there's a palpable sense of grief or that something has gone wrong. How did you find your bad days? How did you select what would happen on each day?
The trick was in this book was to make sure that we did not have anything that was horrible in human history. Therefore, we largely avoided genocide, for example. But alas, people do die. On April 12th, for instance, President Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945, which was a triply tragic day for his widow, Eleanor, who not only found out that her husband had died, she also had to find out that he was with his mistress. And then third, she found out that it was her daughter arranging the trysts.
Yeah.
So that was a bad day indeed for poor Eleanor. But those are the type where we're not looking at things that are ugly. We're looking at human history in its broadest, most absurd range.
But as you say in the title, it's sometimes gleeful. Do you ever worry about being maybe too gleeful about bad days?
Well, I think what the gleeful part of it is, Robin, is the glee about history itself, which is nothing more than a study of human nature. And this is just the frailer side of human nature, the absurd side, the ridiculous side.
Well, what we're going to do with you, Michael Farquhar, is every day this week, we're going to look at what you've picked for the bad day in history. And so we want to start today, May 4th. You picked a moment sort of in art history. It has to do with a mural at 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York. It's, of course, people know the home of NBC. Very Art Deco. The Rockefellers wanted to have a mural in the lobby. This is in the Depression era. And they commissioned the Mexican artist Diego Rivera.
Yes, this was a very bold thing to do in 1933 in the midst of the Depression. You've got the Rockefellers, who are capitalists to their core, commissioning Diego Rivera, who's an avowed communist, and the plan was to feature on one side the opposing views of society, capitalism and socialism, which again, that would really seem to be too hot to touch for those capitalist Rockefellers, but Abby Rockefeller, the family matriarch, wanted it. She wanted Rivera. She admired his work, and so he was retained. And everything seemed to be going along pretty well until Nelson Rockefeller visited the lobby one day to see how work was progressing. And he saw that Rivera had snuck in a little image of that murderous socialist, Vladimir Lenin. Mm. And on May 4th, he wrote to Rivera. He said, "We can't have this. Can you change it?" And Rivera, being the artist, says, "Absolutely not. I will not touch my work. This is how it stands."
So that letter went out on May 4th. You could have also picked the date in February when the work was, as you write, suddenly and unexpectedly smashed to bits. And the Rockefeller family said, "Oh, it was a mistake. We were trying to move it." But Rivera didn't think so.
Rivera sends off this indignant letter. "In destroying my paintings, the Rockefellers have committed an act of cultural vandalism. There yet will be, a justice that prevents the assassination of human creation as of human character."
That's Michael Farquhar, author of Bad Days in History. We're going to be checking in with him every day this week. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, a much more serious story also took place on this day. It also involves the destruction of art and a wound to the country. Today is the 45th anniversary of Kent State, four unarmed students shot dead by equally young National Guard troops who'd been sent to the school in Ohio to respond to a planned rally protesting President Richard Nixon's announcement that he'd expanded the Vietnam War to include the invasion of Cambodia. The history of that day left a mark in many ways. David C. Barnett from Here and Now contributor WCPN in Cleveland has the story of two pieces of public art in Northeast Ohio.
Akron artist Don Drum created a sculpture called Solar Totem No. 1 on the Kent State campus in 1967. He built the towering structure out of a series of half-inch thick steel plates set at different angles.
The idea that sun would come through this, and as the sun comes up and changes during the day, there are different shadows thrown from one plate to the other.
The work was made out of a hard, durable metal, but it was constantly changing. 3 years later, on May 4th, 1970, the sculpture was permanently changed during an anti-war rally when troops from the Ohio National Guard fired on a group of students protesting the U.S. invasion of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. Four students were killed and nine wounded, and one of the bullets pierced Don Drum's sculpture, which stood in the line of fire halfway between the guardsmen and the protesters. Drum was shaken when he saw that bullet hole several days later.
"I was almost crying. I was so shook up because this is my alma mater. That was very emotional to me."
2 months earlier, another piece of art had been famously damaged in Northeast Ohio due to violence. But in this case, the destruction was apparently intentional.
This was made and cast by Rodin. And one of the things that I find most fascinating, it was cast in 1917...
In the early hours of March 24th, 1970, an original casting of Auguste Rodin's The Thinker was blown off its pedestal by a bomb in front of the Cleveland Museum of Art.
What you see here is he's sitting on a huge rock, and the feet area has been splayed apart. The feet are totally blown off.
William Robinson, the Cleveland Museum's director of modern European art, looks up at the enormous work, which was remounted on a new base following the incident. After determining that the damage couldn't be repaired, the museum decided to display the piece as is, damage and all. Robinson says the police blamed a left-wing radical group for the crime, and he finds it ironic that Rodin intended his thinker to be contemplating the foolishness of mankind.
So now you have this figure who's sitting on top of a base that's been blown apart by dynamite over a political event. I think that's very powerful.
Just as powerful as the bullet hole that remains in Don Drum's sculpture at Kent State.
"I let them know early on that I did not want anybody messing with that bullet hole on the Kent's piece. I feel the piece itself should be its own memorial."
And that's exactly what it's become, according to Laura Davis. She's the founding director of Kent State's May 4th Visitor Center, a museum filled with posters, photographs, and other documents of the time.
People are fascinated by the idea of the hole, and people want to touch it, and they want to put their finger through it. It's such a physical reality that shots were fired in this place. It's real. They commonly draw a peace sign around the hole, with the hole in the center of the peace sign, and they write messages about making the world a better place.
Every day, the sun continues to play off the metal plates of solar totem number one, casting shadows in many directions. And for the past 45 years, a shaft of sunlight shines through a 30-caliber bullet hole in one of those plates, illuminating a piece of history. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett.
The United States has taken a new leadership role on the Arctic Council, a group that advises the governments of countries with territory in the region. Canada was the last chair. It had promoted economic development. The U.S. is expected to focus more on climate change. Michael Byers is professor of global politics at the University of British Columbia and author of the book International Law and the Arctic. He joins us from Salt Spring Island in Canada. Professor, welcome. And what does the Arctic Council do exactly?
Well, the Arctic Council was established 2 decades ago to promote cooperation on scientific and environmental matters, and essentially to establish stronger links between Russia and Western countries like the United States. The Arctic was seen as a place where cooperation was easily possible and therefore a good place to start in building stronger relations.
But since then, as some ice has melted especially, it has become more of an economic opportunity for many of these countries.
Well, yes, climate change is more advanced in the Arctic than anywhere else on Earth. And with climate change comes the melting of sea ice and improved accessibility to shipping routes and natural resources. So there is an economic dimension to the activities of Arctic nations, but also there is a collective realization that climate change is very serious and that something has to be done.
Well, and what can the Arctic Council do on that front?
Well, the first thing they can do is to address some of the contributions to climate change that come from Arctic regions. And one of these is called black carbon. Black carbon is produced, for instance, through the use of diesel engines. Diesel generators power many Arctic communities. It's produced through burning of bunker fuel by ships that are transiting Arctic waters. And the Arctic Council is working together to agree on measures to stop the production of black carbon, essentially by putting scrubbers on the different emission stacks of these different engines and vehicles. And it's important to realize the countries at the table. Russia, Canada, Norway, these are major oil and gas exporting countries. These are countries that have quite substantial carbon footprints. And yet they were able to agree within the Arctic Council to show collective leadership at the international level. And that's because they see climate change happening so dramatically before their eyes within their own northern regions.
And we should say the other countries in the Arctic Council are the U.S., Iceland, Sweden, Denmark, and Finland. How do they divvy up the Arctic? How is it determined which country owns what part of the Arctic?
Well, none of the land is contested in the Arctic, with the exception of one tiny island between Canada and Greenland, between two very, very close partners. The disputes that exist concern maritime boundaries. And the good news there is that all of the Arctic countries are using what's called the Law of the Sea, a set of customary rules that were later codified in the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. And they're using these rules to delimit, to agree upon maritime boundaries.
How did you get so interested in the Arctic?
I became interested in the Arctic at the age of 3, when my father, who is a natural scientist, returned from a summer of doing scientific research in Canada's high Arctic. And my first memory is of my father walking off a plane, returning from the Arctic with a new and very bushy beard. And that image has stayed with me forever. The beard only stayed for a day or so until my mom got a hold of a razor. but my interest in the Arctic has persisted now for almost half a century.
And the first time you went to the Arctic was?
First time I went was in 2006, when I had the privilege of sailing through the Northwest Passage on Canada's research icebreaker. It was an 11-day trip, and it changed my life.
What do you mean? How did it change your life?
Well, in various ways, including seeing with my own eyes dramatic evidence of climate change. And in the last 9 years, that has motivated me to do what I can.
What did you see? What was it that you saw?
We sailed through the Northwest Passage in late October 2006, which historically would have been impossible because of the presence of thick, hard, multi-year ice through the entire passage. And in the space of 11 days, we saw no ice. That was October 2006, and the ice melt has continued since then. In late summer, early fall, the Northwest Passage is ice-free. And remember, this is a waterway that stymied hundreds of explorers in the 19th century, with the first voyage only occurring in 1906 by a Norwegian who actually took 3 years because he spent two winters stuck in ice.
That's Michael Byers, a professor of global politics at the University of British Columbia and author of the book International Law and the Arctic, talking with us about the Arctic Council. The U.S. has just assumed chairmanship. Michael Byers, thank you for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.